Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to our daily coverage of the 2019 Iditarod here on Mushing Radio. You can find all of our episodes over on dogworksradio.com. And if you're here in the Mat-Su Valley, you can hear us on KVRF 89.7 or on radiofreepalmer.org. And joining us from Southern California is our co-host, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. There's a very exciting race happening right now, and I'm just looking at the standings before we went on the air, and it looks like in the very front we've got Pete Kaiser, Nick Petit, Jesse Royer, and Yor Olsson, and they are all within about 12 miles or so. Right now, Pete Kaiser and Nick are in the lead, running together, but it's a little bit misleading because, as we talked about yesterday and have talked about on a bunch of different shows, you have to take into account the mandatory rests. And Pete Kaiser has not yet taken his mandatory 8-hour rest, so he'll be taking that when he gets to Caltag, which means that he'll be sitting in Caltag for 8 hours. Whereas other mushers might be taking a much shorter rest in Caltag.
Right. And remember, they also have to take a mandatory 8-hour rest in White Mountain. I know that's much further down the trail, but if you're working on your race strategy and you do that first 8-hour rest closer and closer to White Mountain, counterproductive, isn't it?
Yeah, it really can be. And the 8-hour White Mountain rest, I think, is mostly designed so that mushers don't overrun their dogs too close to the end when they're just really wanting to push forward and finish the race. So that kind of guarantees it levels the playing field a little bit and guarantees that the dogs and the mushers are relatively well rested when they're going for those last 78 miles or so into Nome.
Right. And sort of our focus for the show today is the warm weather on the trail. I've seen lots of reports about that over the last 24 to 36 hours or so. I guess they're really struggling. There were some pictures on Facebook of Michi Kono wearing a rain poncho. A couple of other mushers were in full rain gear. It was very warm. Even one guy was covered up in what looked like a garbage bag to get out of the rain. That's really unseasonable type weather this time of year. I know a couple of days ago we talked about our friend Monica Zappa, who was up near Shaktulik, and she noticed that there was absolutely no wind and no sea ice. And just a quick little story about Monica that I just recalled when I was talking about her. Yesterday, I guess her and her team came into Elam, and everybody ran outside, all the school children and some of the villagers ran outside and met her when she pulled in, and they were really excited, and she was thinking to herself, what is going on? And then she had the wherewithal to say, hey, I am not winning the Iditarod. It was on an entirely separate deal. She wasn't even running the race. But as you saw when we were at Yetna, when Dan, the owner of Yetna Station, was counting down where the mushers were, that he would say, okay, they're at Luces, which is 6 miles, and they're in the Slough, which is 2 miles. All of a sudden, everybody pretty much dropped what they were doing and ran outside. And that's pretty common on the Iditarod Trail at all checkpoints, and including in Nome, where they have that foghorn or that siren that goes off, and folks run out of their houses and greet the people as they're crossing the finish line. It's sort of an Iditarod tradition pretty much anywhere on the trail, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And there's a lot of, because the Iditarod is so spread out, there's a lot of kind of hurry up and wait involved for the volunteers and people at some of the checkpoints. And, you know, so it's a question of getting yourself into place and getting, you know, all of the logistics that go with that, getting the proper people and the proper equipment and the food drop bags and all of that in place ahead of time. and then waiting for the race to slide through. And sometimes that's, you know, it all depends on the trail conditions and in a large extent the weather. And sometimes that happens really quickly, and other times people are just hanging around at the checkpoints and waiting for the teams to come in. And then, of course, once the teams get close, there is kind of a mad dash to get out there and get everything done that needs to be done.
So going back to the weather, what are your thoughts on that? I know that they're predicting warmer temperatures through the rest of the race. I believe it is about 34, 35 degrees right now in Nome. What do you think's happening out there?
You know, it's interesting because even in the past few years when we've had a very warm start of the race, once you get into the interior in the area where most of the teams are now, it's been pretty cold. So even when the race was shifted up to Fairbanks for the restart, once they got a few hundred miles into the race, the temperatures were fairly low, and in some cases extremely low, in some cases like 40, 50 degrees below zero. We haven't seen that pretty much at all this year. I think for the most part, temperatures have been in the 20s and even sometimes in the 30s. And that is just very, very warm for the Iditarod Trail. It's, it's kind of great for humans, but it's very, very warm for these type of dogs. And these dogs, I think, run ideally, you know, when it's zero to about 20 or maybe even 30 below. That's kind of the sweet spot for these dogs to run and do really, really well. When you're dealing with weather that's this warm, you have to be worrying a lot about the dogs becoming dehydrated and making sure that the dogs have enough water to drink or that you're melting snow to give the dogs water. So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect of it is that it's hard for the trail to stay in good condition when it's this warm. It gets much more easily, broken apart. And it makes sense because if you think about where, you know, most people who live on the road system, when you have temperatures that are really, really low and there's snow, the snow sticks to the road and it's you have a fairly good idea of what that's going to be. But when it starts getting up towards, 30 degrees or even above freezing, then you get the situation where during the day it's really sunny and warmer, and a lot of the stuff covering the roads or covering your sidewalk or your lawn will get melted or broken up, especially when cars or people or animals or what have you are going past it. So it's a similar kind of thing with the Iditarod Trail, and it's harder for the trail to stay reasonable. And we've actually seen in a lot of cases on the trail this year, it's been really hard going, and there have been a lot of reports about people having sleds that are damaged and sleds that are, need to be replaced or need to have substantial repairs done to them. So I think that is what's going on here. Unfortunately, I think if the weather holds for the next 4 or 5 days, we're going to see that kind of trail condition most of the way to Nome.
Right. And you know, a lot of mushers would prefer to run primarily in the dark when it's much cooler. The weather helps out the trail in that condition. It freezes it back up. It makes it a little bit more firm. But if you're really competing in the race, it's very difficult to plan only to run when it's cooler or when it's dark. That's not a realistic expectation because now we have much more daylight up here in Alaska than we do in, January, February, even in December. So it's not feasible to just only run in the dark when it's much colder, especially if you're up front. Now, if you're further back, middle to the back of the pack, and you're running a really conservative race where it may be equal run, equal rest, it's much easier to plan those night runs than it is if you're in the front of the pack where you only rest 4 or so hours at a time. It just doesn't work that way in terms of that run rest schedule that we talk a lot about.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that's another thing that goes into your strategy when you're at the front of the pack. And that strategy, as we've talked about in the past, needs to be somewhat flexible so that if it suddenly gets warmer or, you know, suddenly gets colder, or if a storm comes in, that you're able to adjust your race plan and not be stuck doing something that doesn't match the current conditions.
Right. So what other stories do you have for us? I know a couple of days ago we talked about a lost plane. I don't think that they have found that. I know that they have reported that it was not involved with Iditarod in any formal capacity, meaning communications or moving up and down the trail or, you know, Iditarod Air Force or anything like that. But they have not said who was on the plane. And I assume that they're still looking for that. Is that right?
Yeah, I have not seen any further updates on it. So I assume also that they are still looking for the plane, which is a, you know, a bit of a scary proposition, because it's now been a while. I think it's been two nights that the plane has been missing.
Right. Another story is, or another report is something you had talked about over on either Facebook or Twitter. You talked about the back of the packers traveling together. And I know we've talked a lot about this on the show, about that non-competitive rule, and you have to be so many hours or so far in distance in regards to the leaders of the race. And you commented that it's less likely that they would force more than one team out, but it happens quite often with just one musher kind of struggling in the back. Is that right?
Yeah, and, you know, it used to be that the rules have sort of changed a few times over the years. It used to be that there were very specific time distances, like at a certain checkpoint you could only be 24 hours behind the leader, and at a different checkpoint you could only be 48 or 96 hours. They've changed that now so that it's at the discretion of the race officials, which is both better and worse. I think it's better in that it gives the race officials more flexibility. So, you know, for example, when there is weather, or when there's something extraordinary that happens that's unique to the race, they can take that into account. It's more frustrating, I think, for some of the mushers, especially the teams that are deemed uncompetitive and forced to scratch. But in my observing of the Iditarod over the years, it seems that when someone is forced to scratch like this, it's almost always because there is one musher who is significantly behind the pack. So when there's two or three or four people who are traveling together at the back, it's been my experience that generally the race officials will let those teams all continue. You know, they also have to keep moving forward. So you can't just camp in the middle of the race after you've taken your 24 for two or three days. You have to keep moving forward. But it's been my experience that as an observer, as a fan, that they don't tend to force people to scratch if they're traveling in a small group.
Right. You know, there's an interesting story towards the back of the pack there with musher Michael Baker, and he is running the B team or puppy team of Matthew Failer, who is doing very well. I'm not sure of the position of either one of them, but Matt is way up there and maybe even the top 10, whereas Michael is much further back. And it's a really telling sign of two different types of race strategies out of one kennel. I know we've talked a lot about that here on the show in regards to run rest schedules and couples or multiple teams running in the same race, or the puppy team and the A team and whatnot. But what's so interesting is I think that they were about 100 miles different in mileage. But what was even more telling is they were traveling down the trail at almost the exact same speed on average. I believe that, Michael Baker was 7.87 miles an hour, and Matthew Failer was 7.81 miles an hour. And that's really interesting on a couple of notes, and this is kind of my musher's perspective. When you travel with your B team or with your handler or with the puppy team or whatever, if you're doing training runs with them, often they will run at the exact same speed. Our friend and handler Miranda, she and I ran in a couple of races over the last couple of years, and we would finish those races. Now, these are much shorter races, but we would finish those races in just a couple of seconds of each other because we are always running together, neck and neck. So our dog teams are almost running at the same speed all the time. And I found it real interesting that it's the same case, even over a 1,000-mile race, where two dog teams that are trained together run such a similar speed and such a similar style, even if their race schedule or race plan is much different.
Yeah, and, you know, with these longer races, generally speaking, the people who are running the B teams or the puppy teams, their goal is to give the dogs a great experience running a much longer race. So they are not concerned with they're not generally concerned with what place they're in. They're concerned with keeping the dogs happy and keeping the dogs moving. And a lot of times that means that even though they're going at the same speed when they're moving, they'll have longer rests, or they'll stop more frequently, or they'll, you know, interrupt runs to snack the dogs and just sort of rest for 20 minutes or a half hour before continuing, and then take longer rests when they're either camping or when they're in checkpoints. And what that does is it creates this this great sense in the dogs that being on the trail and being in a race is a really fun thing to do. And you would rather have a dog that is raring to keep going than a dog that has been run a little bit too far and is too tired and is dragging or doesn't want to run at all. So, you know, you're training these dogs, especially younger dogs, yearlings or dogs that are, you know, 3 years old or whatever, that they can be dogs who will step up and become part of the main team, the more competitive team in the next year or following years. So it's a very different kind of strategy for exactly what you're doing in running the race.
Right, and just a quick update on that. I'm looking at the standings right now. It looks like Matthew Failer is out of Eagle Island. He is currently in fifth place, and his puppy team or B team, whichever it is that he is running, Mike Baker, is in 44th. position, and he is in Iditarod. Right off the top of your head, Alex, do you know how far they are apart? Can you see that on the computer where you're at, the distance between the two?
Yeah, it looks like Matt is at mile 599, and Michael Baker is at I just had him, and then I lost him. And Michael Baker is at Iditarod, which is mile 432. So, you know, they're about 160, 170 miles apart.
Very interesting, kind of the tale of two different teams. So before we jump over to our musher profile of the evening, do you have any other stories or news and notes about the race as we sit?
Yeah, a couple of small things. There's an interesting article that was in over on KNOM about how Your Olsom is carrying the ashes of musher Rudy Demoski along the trail to scatter them along the trail. And Rudy is a very well-known musher from early Iditarods, and had come to Willow to help Your train his dogs. And there's a quote from Yor where he said he would sit in the side-by-side and look at the dogs and tell stories from the old days, and I think the main thing I learned from him was to enjoy life. He was such a happy guy, even the smallest thing would get him fired up and laughing, and up until the end, he was just super happy. So we've heard over the years of people scattering ashes along the Iditarod Trail, and this is another case of someone whose ashes are being scattered along the Iditarod Trail. Most of the time we hear about dogs being scattered, but this time it's a musher himself. And I also have a quick update for some of the ugly dog stuff that we talked about yesterday. First thing is that I have been told that I got the gender wrong of one of Blair Braverman's dogs, that Jenga is actually a female dog and not a male dog, so I apologize for getting that wrong. And the other thing is, we had talked about this this school that was in Nikolai that was trying to raise money for the school trip to Anchorage, and they have stopped the donations for this now, but it was mostly through Blair's fans. The Ugly Dogs was funded overnight, and they raised, I believe it was $7,000 on this GoFundMe. And Q, who is traveling on a snow machine, was further back and reported that he just got into Nikolai, I believe overnight, and found the principal of the school, because a lot of people are staying inside the school in Nikolai. And when she found out that he was Blair's husband, that she burst into tears and told him about what had happened. And apparently this, you know, Blair has been racing. She didn't know anything about this. Q was on the snow machine and having some trouble with sections of the trail, and he didn't know anything about this. So he just learned that all of this stuff had happened when he got into Nikolai. And he said on Twitter that this is one of the best moments of his life, was when the principal told him that Blair's fans had done this. And they also have, since we were on the air yesterday, they've started a hashtag for these type of activities, which is hashtag IGiveARod. And if you look for tweets that are marked with hashtag IGiveARod or IGiveARod 2019, there is a list of other projects that the Ugly Dogs are trying to support. They are mostly projects involving Alaska schools or native schools, although not exclusively. And a couple of her fans messaged me privately and urged me to encourage people not to think that this is just an activity for fans of Blair Braverman, but that this is something that anyone who wants to help support these causes can participate in. So, and again, this is a lot of people who are giving small amounts of money, $10, $20. But you put a few hundred people giving $10 or $20, and that adds up to something that can do an awful lot of good and make a huge difference in the life of these kids in the villages in Alaska.
You know, I said this yesterday. In all the years that we're reporting on this, and you and I have been doing this for 8 years, Alex, and I just saw on Facebook that this is my 11th year of somehow covering the Iditarod, either on a podcast or through social media or something of the such. And I have never seen anything like this in terms of the amount of reach that's happening this year. It's just amazing to me. You know, as you said, these folks are out there racing, but the fans are doing something that's really never been done before in terms of raising all this money and helping out on all these projects. I just have never seen it happen like this. And it reminds me of like what happens in the NFL with, you know, the players that are involved with charities, and, you know, they're out there doing their thing on the field, and, you know, everybody behind the scenes is helping raise money for whatever charity it is for, whether it's, you know, a run walk or cancer research or homelessness or whatever. It's sort of the fans taking care of the projects. And that's exactly what it seems like is happening during this year's race. I can only wonder how much further this can go and what will happen after the race is over. I wonder if this type of enthusiasm and positivity and good vibes will continue after the race, or it's just sort of kind of a moment in time. What do you think?
I am hopeful that it will continue after the race. I think certainly it'll slow down. But even if this is something that only happens during the race, you know, that's a really good thing. And I think it's hard to overestimate the type of life-changing experience this can be for kids who grow up in small bush villages, who are able to do things thanks to, you know, dozens or hundreds of people that they probably will never meet, who just think that this is a good idea to help people.
It's an awesome experience, and I wish them the luck that they're doing well. And I think that they're helping out a heck of a lot of people, and you have to commend that on all fronts for sure. So keep up the good work, guys. What was that hashtag one more time?
I give a rod. So I believe it's okay. IGIVEAROD.
And I'll put that in the show notes so it comes out when we post the show. All right, Alex, we have a few minutes to talk about our musher of the evening. Who is that?
Okay, so the musher of the evening tonight is Nicholas Wickstrand, who is running as an Iditarod rookie. He's running the B team for Pete Kaiser. He's 28 years old. He is a Norwegian, but he's not someone who came up through the teams that are in Norway, but actually has been handling for Pete Kaiser for the past couple of years. He lives in Norway in a place called Svalbard, and he's a veteran of the Norwegian Air Force, and he spent time there working with dogs. And back in Norway, he's also worked as an Arctic region tour guide. He took a course called Mushing and Outdoors Life at a Norwegian school, and then after that, he saw an ad where Pete Kaiser was looking for a handler. And so he answered the ad. He communicated back and forth with Pete Kaiser over email, had never met or spoken to him until he arrived at the kennel as a handler about 2.5 years ago. He says that this is going to be his last big Alaskan adventure. He's headed home to Norway a few weeks after Iditarod. And he has been running a very conservative, slower race, the type of race we were talking about that is common for B teams or puppy teams. And he said his goal is just to get as many dogs as possible to Nome and keep them happy and healthy. Up until now, the longest race he's run in the past was a 300-mile race. So he's just concentrating on making sure that the dogs have as good an experience as possible. His dog team, they're not all young dogs, although the youngest one is just 1.5 years old. But the oldest dog on his team is an Iditarod veteran who's 7. He's run the Willow 300 twice, the Cusco 300 once, and qualified for the Iditarod, and now is running with Pete's team. And he said that he said at McGrath that his team is doing really well. They went a little bit slowly from Nikolai, but that's what he expected because of all of the loose snow and running during the day. And he said that he, when he finally got to Bethel, it was a severe change from what he was used to in terms of where he was living. And he said that he's not sure what he's going to do after he leaves Alaska. He doesn't rule out returning to the Iditarod, but he said that if he does that, he wants to start his own kennel and raise his own dogs. And he said that the dogs that he's running with, he's run between 2,000 and 3,000 miles in training with these dogs. And he said that everything is going well. The dogs are very happy. and he's having a great time being in parts of Alaska that he hasn't been in before and getting to enjoy that with his dog friends. And he said, you know, as long as the dogs are happy, I'm happy.
Excellent stuff. Yeah, I did not know anything about Nicholas. I didn't know he was running for Pete Kaiser's team. It's my understanding he did very well in one of the mid-distance races. Is that right?
Yeah, I think he finished third in the Willow 300 the last time he ran, which I'm not sure if it was this year or last year. But yeah, he's been doing very well, and you know, it's a different sort of thing. He's not racing to finish quickly. He's not racing to win. He's racing to give these dogs a great experience so that one or two of them, you know, in a year or two can graduate up to being in Pete Kaiser's A team. And if they aren't able to do that, they might be able to be on the A team of another Iditarod musher. So it's just
right.
A different way of looking at running these 1,000 miles.
You know, what is interesting, and that sort of ties back to when we were talking about Matthew Failer and Mike Baker of running that B team in a race, whether it's Iditarod or a mid-distance race. If that puppy team is coming in second or third in a major mid-distance race, that again just shows the type of training that these guys are doing during the season. And, you know, it's all business. It's not, they may be out there for the dogs to have a good time and have a good experience, but they're still out there racing, aren't they?
They really are. And I was just looking at the tracker, and it looks like Nicholas is at Shagaluk now, which is not too far behind where the leaders are. His average moving speed when he's not resting is 7.8 miles per hour, which is great, you know, which is not too far behind where the leaders are.
Very good. So tomorrow, Alex, we will be a week into the race. That will be officially day 8 of the race when we're on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening. And we typically have a winner Tuesday or Wednesday of that week. Do you see that happening again? I don't see any race times being beaten in terms of records or anything like that. But I would imagine that we will still be on track for a winner to come into Nome either Tuesday or Wednesday. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, too. Chances are really good that we'll see by the time we're on the air tomorrow, we'll have the leaders will be on their way up the Bering Coast. And then from there, it's just a matter of time. If the weather holds, then I think we could have a winner sometime Tuesday, and almost definitely, if not Tuesday, then early Wednesday.
Very good. All right, Alex, we are definitely out of time. I want to thank all of our listeners that tuned in yesterday when we talked about Blair Braverman and the Ugly Dogs crew. That was by far one of our most popular episodes of all time, and I want to make sure that we give a big shout out to all those folks out there on Twitter in particular that shared our show and commented on our show and gave us a lot of good comments and good vibes, and thanks to for us being on the air. That really helped us for sure. And with that, Alex, I will see you, or I guess hear you, tomorrow on the show. And on behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.